Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, October 5th. I'm your reader, Dagna. We will begin today with the mini editorial on the front page of the Sioux City Journal, and that is written by Jackie DeWall of Sioux City. And Jackie writes, "Love the murals on the buildings downtown. Just saw the one on Wesley Parkway. What a wonderful way to show off our older buildings. If you have not seen them, please take the time to drive by. It is well worth a drive. How wonderful they are." Again, this was written by Jackie DeWall of Sioux City. Our first article is written by Mason Doctor of the Sioux City Journal, and the headline is End of an Era, Sioux City Roadway Inn Under Demolition. Demolition is ongoing at a longtime Sioux City hotel. The Roadway Inn and Conference Center complex at 1401 Zenith Drive had sat empty and boarded up for 3 years before wrecking crews arrived this fall. The Interstate 29 adjacent hotel was built in 1962 and operated as a Holiday Inn during the 1970s and the 1980s. In more recent years, the 106-room hotel was a Quality Inn. In the early 2000s, the property traded hands several times, including a sheriff's sale in June of 2001. The most recent recorded owner was an Albuquerque, New Mexico-based entity called Hem Ami Iowa, Inc., which purchased the property for $1.7 million in 2003. After a $1 million renovation completed a year and a half later, the hotel became a Roadway Inn, part of the Choice Hotels chain. In 2018, the property had been listed for sale by KW Commercial Siouxland at an asking price of $3.15 million for the 4.78-acre site. Demolition and redevelopment had been a likely outcome since the hotel's closure, due in part to the dated design of the mid-century motel-style property, which occupies far more square footage of land than most modern hotels. It was also in poor condition. Sioux City Code Enforcement Manager Darrell Bullock said Monday that the property had been red-tagged as unfit for occupancy for some time due to what he described as severe dilapidation. The property was red-tagged, but this is a private demolition from the owner of the property. They're doing it themselves. They've chosen to tear it down rather than make repairs. Marty Dodery, the city's economic development director, said the property is certainly a prime corner of real estate due to its proximity to Interstate 29 and Hamilton Boulevard. Both Dodery and Bullock said that, as far as they know, the property has not been sold recently, and county property records show no sale since 2003. "I know they're trying to sell it and develop it. We're not working with anyone right now. We've had inquiries about it from time to time," Dodery said. Our next article headline is, "Leaked records show how the rich hide assets, some hide their money in South Dakota." Calls grew Monday for an end to the financial secrecy and shell companies that have allowed many of the world's richest and most powerful people to hide their wealth from tax collectors. The outcry came after a report revealed the way the world leaders, billionaires, and others have used offshore accounts to keep trillions of dollars out of government treasuries over the past quarter century, limiting the resources that could be put to work helping the poor or combating climate change. The report by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists brought promises of tax reform and demands for resignations and investigations, as well as explanations and denials from those targeted. The investigation, dubbed the Pandora Papers, was published Sunday and involved 600 journalists from 150 media outlets in 117 countries. Hundreds of politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers have hidden their wealth in shell companies and used other tactics to hide their investments in mansions, exclusive beachfront property, yachts, and other assets, according to a review of nearly 12 million files obtained from 14 firms located around the world. Many of the tax dodges are legal. Gabriel Zuckman, a University of California, Berkeley economist who studies income inequality and taxes, said in a statement, "One solution is obvious: ban shell companies, corporations with no economic substance whose sole purpose is to avoid taxes or other laws." The legality is a true scandal, the activist and science fiction author Corey Doctorow wrote on Twitter. Each of these arrangements represents a risible fiction. A shell company is a business. A business is a person. That person resides in a file drawer in the desk of a bank official on some distant treasure island. The more than 330 current and former politicians identified as beneficiaries of the secret accounts include Jordan's King Abdullah II, former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, Czech Republic Prime Minister Andrej Babis, Kenya President Uhuru Kenyatta, Ecuador's President Guillermo Lasso, and associates of both Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan and Russian President Vladimir Putin. The billionaires called out in the report include Turkish construction mogul Erman Ilyak and Robert T. Brockman, the former CEO of software maker Reynolds & Reynolds. Some of those targeted strongly denied the claims on Monday. The new data leak must be a wake-up call, said Sven Giegold, a Green Party lawmaker in the European Parliament. Global tax evasion fuels global inequality. We need to expand and sharpen the countermeasures now. Oxfam International, a British consortium of charities, applauded the Pandora Papers for exposing brazen examples of greed that deprived countries of tax revenue that could be used to finance programs and projects for the greater good. This is where our missing hospitals are, Oxfam said in a statement. This is where the pay packets sit of all the extra teachers and firefighters and public servants we need. The European Commission, the 27-nation European Union's executive arm, said in response to the revelations that it is preparing new legislative proposals to enhance tax transparency and reinforce the fight against tax evasion. The Pandora Papers are a follow-up to a similar project released in 2016 called the Panama Papers, compiled by the same journalistic group. The latest bombshell is even more expansive, relying on data leaked from 14 different service providers doing business in 38 different jurisdictions. The records date back to the 1970s, but most are from 1996 to 2020. The investigation dug into accounts registered in familiar offshore havens, such as the British Virgin Islands, Seychelles, Hong Kong, and Belize, but some are the secret accounts also scattered around in trusts set up in the United States, including 81 in South Dakota. Senator Sherrod Brown, an Ohio Democrat who heads the Senate Banking Committee, decried these gross abuses of our legal and tax system, which he said enable criminals and fuel global inequality by allowing wealthy elites to avoid paying their fair share while working families are forced to make up the difference. The investigation found advisors helped Abdullah set up at least three dozen shell companies from 1995 to 2017, helping the Jordanian monarch buy 14 homes worth more than $106 million in the United States and the UK. One was a $23 million California Ocean View property bought in 2017 through a British Virgin Island company. Abdullah denied any impropriety in a comment Monday by the Royal Palace, citing security needs for keeping the transaction quiet and saying no public funds were used. U.S. attorneys from Abdullah said he isn't required to pay taxes under his country's law and has not misused public funds. They said most of the companies and properties are not connected to the king or no longer exist, though they declined to provide details. Tony Blair, the UK Prime Minister from 1997 to 2007, became the owner of an $8.8 million Victorian building in 2017 by buying a British Virgin Island company that held the property, which now hosts the law firm of his wife, Sherry Blair, according to the investigation. The two bought the company from the family of Bahrain's Industry and Tourism Minister. Buying the company shares instead of the London building saved the Blairs more than $400,000 in property taxes. Sherry Blair said her husband was not involved in the purchase, which she said was meant to bring the company and the building back into the UK tax and regulatory regime. She also said that the seller, for their own purposes, only wanted to sell the company, which is now closed. A lawyer for the Al-Sayyin said they compiled the UK laws. Our next story is about real estate values, and the headline is, State orders 22% assessment increase. Apartments and multi-residential properties would be impacted. Owners of apartment buildings and other multi-residential properties face a 22% increase in their valuations for tax purposes under an order issued by the state. Sioux City Assessor John Lawson said Monday he is appealing the Department of Revenue's equalization order, saying it's the result of an incorrect calculation in a department presentation in the fall of 2019 that advised assessors on the correct way to calculate the range of values for multi-residential properties. When we set values, we were setting them based on their presentation and believed our calculations were within the tolerance range, Lawson said Monday. State law requires city and county assessors every 2 years to reset valuations for all classes of property to ensure equity in the property tax system. Assessors consider factors such as local sales, new construction, and changes to individual parcels. The 2021 assessments will be used to calculate the local property taxes for the 2022-23 fiscal year, with the first of two payments due in September of 2022. The new assessments the city assessor released in March called for an average increase of 5.5% for multi-residential properties. If upheld on appeal, it would raise the overall increase to 27.5%. The owner of a property assessed at $100,000 would see an additional $10,000 in taxable valuation after factoring in a rollback. Based on the current levy of $35.52 per $1,000 in assessed value, that owner would pay an additional $355 in property taxes. The state defines multi-residential properties as having three or more living quarters. Among properties covered include apartment buildings, mobile home parks and nursing homes, and assisted living facilities, as well as upper floors of commercial buildings converted for housing. In Sioux City, the equalization order would impact 580 properties with a total assessed value of $309 million. Last Friday, the city's assessor's office mailed the multi-residential property owners official notices of the new assessments. If an owner believes the new assessment is more than current market value of the property, they may file an appeal with the Sioux City Board of Review from October 9th through October 31st. Since October 31st falls on a Sunday, the appeal must be returned or postmarked by November 1st. The notices include an instruction sheet on how to appeal and a blank income and expense statement to assist in providing information for the Board of Review to assist in determining the correct value. The board may remove up to the 22% increase, but cannot lower the value below what it was after the regular appeal process last spring. Lawson noted the results of the city assessor's appeal will not be known before the end of this month's individual appeal period. As part of an equalization order, the Department of Revenue also ordered the city assessor to lower assessments for agriculture property by 10%, Lawson said. There are only 256 ag parcels with a total valuation of $7 million within the city limits. No notices will be sent to the agriculture property owners because the values are decreasing, Lawson said. The equalization order does not affect new assessments for any other class of property, including residential and commercial. Residential valuations surged by an average of 8.5% compared to the last biennial reassessment in 2019. The assessor's office attributed the increase to a robust local housing market as home sales jumped by over 30% last year, despite the COVID-19 pandemic that brought on a recession. Commercial property assessments in Sioux City grew by an average of 6.5%. Many owners with high assessments could face higher tax bills, but they won't know for sure until local governments set their new tax rates next spring. Other factors, such as the rollback, a state-imposed limit on assessments, and various state tax credits, also will determine whether owners pay more or less in taxes. And then there's a sidebar on how to appeal your tax valuation. Property owners who are concerned about their values have multiple options to try to resolve the issue. They can contact City Assessor John Lawson's office at 712-279-6535 and talk with the appraiser before April 1st. Any errors found in the information will be corrected, Lawson said. An informal appeal process runs between, this was for last spring, so the dates were October 9th through October 31st. During that time, the appraiser can only change the value if property owners agree and sign a stipulation regarding the property. Property owners may appeal their values to the Sioux City Board of Review. To assist with the process, the assessor has put into action an online appeal program at beacon.schneidercor.com. And I'll spell that, beacon.schneidercorp.com. This program will appear only during the times property owners may file a valid appeal. It can be used to fill out the appeal form, find comparable properties, attach additional documents and pictures, and then transmit the information to the Board of Review in one step without having to leave your house. Beersford man pleads not guilty to sex charges. A Beersford, South Dakota man on Monday pleaded not guilty to sexually assaulting a toddler and possessing dozens of photos of videos depicting child pornography. Mark Cornish, 30, entered his plea in Union County Circuit Court to single counts of first-degree rape and sexual exploitation of a minor and 39 counts of possession of child pornography. On August 29th, police seized Cornish's cell phone and laptop during a search of his home, where he lived with his fiancée and their two young children. According to court documents, investigators searching the contents found dozens of downloaded images and nudes. Videos of nude children, some engaged in sexual activity. Investigators also found a video of the rape of a child they believed was taken on Cornish's phone inside his home. Authorities began their investigation on August 26 when police were notified of Cornish's behavior with a 13-year-old girl at the Family Dollar store. The girl told police that she had babysat Cornish's two children and that she and Cornish had kissed, hugged, and cuddled at his home. She also admitted to sending him a nude photo of herself and that he had sent her photos of his penis. Cornish was charged in 2018 in Georgia with sodomizing a child under age 10 and 7 counts of child molestation. Those charges were later dropped. After 40 Powerball drawings, jackpot hit $685 million. After 40 drawings without a big Powerball winner, maybe Monday night's 41st attempt will be different. Thanks to nearly 4 months of futility, the Powerball jackpot has climbed to an estimated $685 million, making it the 8th largest in the U.S. lottery history. No one has won the game's grand prize since June 5th. Every drawing now sets a record, topping the previous mark of 36 drawings that ended in January 2021. The longer the game goes without a grand prize winner, the larger the payout will grow. The jackpot drought is by design, as the game's long odds of 292.2 million to 1 are intended to generate massive prizes that draw more players. Lottery officials are quick to note that even as no one wins the jackpot, plenty of people have won smaller prizes, including 2.8 million players in Saturday's drawing alone. Those winnings range from $1 million to $4. The $685 million promoted prize is for a winner who chooses the annuity option, paid over 29 years. Nearly all big winners take the cash option, which for Monday night's drawing is an estimated $485.5 million. Either prize option would also be subject to taxes. Powerball is played in 45 states, plus Washington, D.C., the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. Sioux City businessman to plead guilty to misbranded drugs. A Sioux City advertising business owner intends to plead guilty to selling thousands of doses of drugs for erectile dysfunction that had not been approved for sale in the United States. David Kempema, owner of Canned Ads, faces one count of introduction into interstate commerce of misbranded drugs with intent to defraud. He has waived indictment and, according to documents filed in U.S. District Court in Sioux City, will plead guilty. No hearings have been scheduled. He was convicted of a similar crime in 2011. According to court documents, Kempema sold all-natural meal and other purported dietary supplements that contained the active ingredients found in Viagra and Cialis, two federally approved prescription drugs for treatment of erectile dysfunction. From February 14, 2014 through December 5, 2018, Kempema advertised and sold drugs branded as dietary supplements that contained Sildenafil and Orogar, two drugs that contained sildenafil, the active drug ingredient in Viagra, and Tadalista, a new drug containing tadalafil, the active drug ingredient in Cialis. When he received orders for all natural male and other supplements, Kempema would provide the customer with Sildenafil and Orogra, which were blue, diamond-shaped tablets similar in appearance to Viagra, or Tadalista, orange oblong-shaped tablets. Sildenafil, Orogra, and Tadalista have not received U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval for lawful use in the United States. Kempema is charged with selling the drugs without proper labeling, providing directions for use, offering them for sale under the names of other drugs, and dispensing them without prescriptions. Court documents say he obtained the drugs from India and/or Germany and obtained or attempted to obtain 4,059 pills for resale. Kempema's attorney, Priscilla Forsyth of Sioux City, declined to comment. Kempema pleaded guilty in 2011 in federal court in Sioux City to trafficking misbranded drugs with intent to defraud or mislead for selling more than 3,700 pills that he marketed as Viagra and Cialis, but were instead drugs he had obtained from India that had not received FDA approval for use in the United States. He was sentenced to 60 days in jail in order to pay $23,723 in restitution. We'll now move to some news from the city council meeting last night. Our first headline is nearly $350,000 approved for nonprofits. The Sioux City Council, by voting to approve its consent agenda Monday, green-lighted a resolution to award $348,122 in COVID-19 funding to 15 nonprofits. On December 21, 2020, the city accepted Community Development Block Grant coronavirus funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. A review committee comprised of city staff reviewed and ranked 19 applications from nonprofits requesting $581,682 total, based on scoring criteria from HUD. But four of the applications, including one from Bishop Helan High School, did not meet HUD requirements. Bishop Helan was hoping to secure funding for locker room and bathroom renovations at Helan's Catholic Youth Organization Center. Before the vote, Councilman Pete Greckin asked Neighborhood Service Manager Jill Watershine if it would make a difference if the school's president, Dr. John Flannery, talked directly with the HUD representative. Watershine told Gretkin that HUD typically refers representatives of local nonprofits to information on its website or back to her office. In order to qualify, Wanderscheid said Bishop Helan would have to document that at least 51% of all the people using those locker rooms and bathrooms are low to moderate income, which she said would be difficult to do. CYO Center bathroom and locker room users also could not be required to attend religious education classes under HUD requirements. The only thing that we didn't quite broach, and this could be something that we could be dealt with later, we would like to see a stronger connection directly to COVID, because that's a HUD issue too, Wanderscheid said. That would be the third thing, where we would need a much stronger statement that says we need these locker rooms and bathrooms due to COVID. Greckin said he thinks the project might qualify if HUD knows people other than those who attend Bishop Helan will be using their locker rooms and bathrooms. It's not just the students of the Catholic high school, it's the community and the people who are attending what they want to do with it to keep the people as safe and healthy as they can, he said. After talking with Watershed, Flannery said he understood that religious instruction might be a barrier to receiving funding, but he noted that the facilities doesn't have handless toilets and handless sinks and handless paper towels, which meets the COVID requirement. School-wide, we have documentation that about 78% of our students are low to moderate income, said Flannery, who also noted that 59% of Sioux City community school districts, some of whom may also receive the facility, use a facility, receive free and reduced lunch. It would be pretty easy, I guess, to maybe make that assumption that the majority of the families that are coming in that are using the facility would qualify for the low to moderate. It might be difficult for us to track without a survey. Council hears presentation on highway interchange. Iowa DOT budgets $12.5 million for US 20, US 75 interchange project. The Sioux City Council heard a presentation Monday about U.S. 20 Gordon Drive U.S. Highway 25 interchange modifications, which are slated to occur as the Iowa Department of Transportation prepares to consolidate all of its Sioux City facilities into one new location. The Iowa DOT has programmed $12.5 million for the reconstruction of about 2 miles of the highway from the Gordon Drive interchange to Little Whiskey Creek to even the elevation between the eastbound and westbound lanes. Plans also call for the elimination of the interchange's current traffic loops and the addition of traffic signals to control traffic. Generally, we are reconstructing all pavement. We're going to reconfigure the interchange. We're going to improve the grade through the area as well, said Dakin Schultz, District 3 Transportation Planner. It's looking long-term, looking at the future and the growth of Sioux City toward the east. The improvement project, which Schultz said is set to begin in 2023, is connected to the construction of the new Iowa DOT facility. The building is being built on 50 acres on the north side of U.S. Highway 20. The location will also be home to the Siouxland Interstate Metropolitan Planning Commission, or SIMCO, which plans to move its downtown Sioux City offices to the new office and bus storage facility on land lease from Iowa DOT. During the citizen concerns portion of last week's council meeting, Tom Anderson raised concerns about the replacing the current U.S. 25, U.S. 75 cloverleaf on Sioux City's east end with a diamond interchange of two stoplights on Highway 20. He claimed the changes will result in rear-end collisions, huge backups, and traffic jams. Anderson did not attend Monday's meeting. Where Buchanan Avenue is, will that be the right turnout only then? Mayor Bob Scott asked Schultz. Schultz said that will not be the case. He said that IDOT will leave it as it currently is. Scott also asked Schultz whether the off-ramp on U.S. 75 will be removed. Schultz said the high-speed ramp is going away, as are the two loops to the north. What we are doing is we're matching up the intersections, introducing traffic signals at the two intersections. Along with that is also a separated right turn lane to an auxiliary lane for the westbound to northbound, Schultz explained. South Dakota man identified in fatal crash. South Dakota authorities have identified a Vermilion, South Dakota man as a victim of a single vehicle crash Friday near Tabor. Tron Cook Sr., 38, was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash, which occurred at 7:40 a.m. on South Dakota Highway 50, about 2 miles south of Tabor. According to the South Dakota Department of Public Safety, Cook was eastbound in a 2002 Cadillac Seville and failed to negotiate a curve. The car left the road and rolled. Cook, who was not wearing a seatbelt, was thrown from the vehicle. The South Dakota Highway Patrol continues to investigate the crash. We'll now move to the sports section and we'll do a local sports roundup. And the first headline is Morningside Women Lead GPAC Fall Classic. The Morningside University women's golf team had a 35-stroke lead after one round at the Great Plains Athletic Conference Fall Classic, as the Mustangs put up a round one score of 304, with Briarcliff currently second overall at 339. The Mustangs are also dominating so far on the individual side, with Morningside golfers currently in the top four spots. Sophomore Sophia Castellan is currently first in the standings with a score of 74, and Maria Nava is the runner-up at 76. Maria Zarilla and Maya Badosa are tied for third place at 77, with Megan Hinker of Dakota Wesleyan and Kendra Plack are fifth and sixth with respective scores of 79 and 80. All five Mustang golfers are currently in the top 15. On the team side, Dort is tied with Mount Marty for 5th place with a team score of 348. Northwestern is in 10th place with a 380. The GPAC Fall Classic will conclude with Round 2 on Tuesday. Tee time will be at 10 a.m. Then high school boys golf, the South Dakota Class A State Golf Championship. The Vermilion High School boys golf team is currently 4th in the team standings at the Class A South Dakota State Golf Meet. The Tanagers have a score of 340 through round one, one stroke back of West Central, and eight back of second place Aberdeen Roncalli. T area currently leads with the field with a score of 329, while T area golfer Eric Munson is currently in first place with a score of 74. Carter Hansen is Vermilion's highest placing athlete so far with a score of 83, which is tied for 17th, while TJ Tracy is tied for 19th with an 84. At 86, Trey Hansen is tied for 23rd overall, while Ben Burbach is tied for 26th with a score of 87. The state championship meet will conclude on Tuesday with round two. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, October 5th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Our first one is Carol Malloy, 69, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, October 2nd. Service will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City, 4125 Orleans Avenue. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. today, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Carol was born March 13, 1952 in Emerson, Nebraska, to Lester and Lorraine Anderson. On May 3, 1969, Carol married Daniel Malloy. Carol worked several years at Western States, then was co-owner of Billy's Furniture, and was currently employed at the Sioux City Community Schools. Family was everything to Carol. She also enjoyed playing cards with her family and friends, along with traveling to Nevada and visiting the local casinos. Carol is survived by her husband Daniel, sons Daniel Malloy II, and Billy Malloy. Grandchildren Kea, Michaela, Casey, Caitlin, and Keaton. Great-grandchild Dylan, Maine, all of Sioux City, and several siblings. She was preceded in death by her parents and brother Randy Anderson. Macklin Benjamin Clancy, 94, of Sioux City, died Sunday, October 3rd, at a local nursing home. Services will be at 11 a.m. on Thursday at the Christie Smith Funeral Home's Larkin Chapel, located at 2320 Outer Drive North in Sioux City, with Father Jerome Cosgrove officiating. Burial will be on Friday at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service on Thursday at the funeral home. Condolences can be left for the family at www.christysmith.com. Macklin was born September 14, 1927 to Andrew M. and Lillian Clancy at Hardy, Iowa. He grew up on the family farm attending Hardy Public Schools through the 10th grade, graduated in 1945 from Renwick High School, Renwick, Iowa. Macklin entered the U.S. Army Air Corps in 1946 and was honorably discharged in 1947. After his time in the service, he returned home to work on the family farm. He married Madonna Margaret Fleske on November 29, 1952 at Fort Dodge. He later attended the University of Iowa and earned a degree in civil engineering in 1955. While at the University of Iowa, he was a member of the Tau Beta Phi engineering fraternity. After college, the couple moved to Sioux City, where he started his 35-year career with Klinger Young Glove Construction as a design engineer, retiring in 1992. In 2006, he helped start Max Auto Repair with his son John in Sioux City. Mac enjoyed traveling, Iowa wrestling, walking, doing crossword puzzles, playing chess, and spending time with his family. He was a member of St. Michael Church of the Holy Cross in Sioux City and the Knights of Columbus. Macklin also volunteered with Hospice of Siouxland. He is survived by his wife, Madonna, three sons, Gregory of Iowa City, Paul of Sioux City, and John of Sioux City. Two daughters, Patty Jacobson of Dakota City, and Kate Clancy and her significant other, Jeff of Chaska, Minnesota. 11 grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded by each of his parents, son Brian Clancy, two grandchildren, Jennifer and Anthony, and two brothers, Andrew and Gerald. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials to Hospice of Siouxland. Dorothy A. Kuster, Sioux City, 85, died Friday, October 1st. Services will be October 8th at 10:30 a.m. at the Christie Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel at 1801 Morningside Avenue. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be October 7th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Cheryl D. Martinez, Dakota City, 71, died Sunday, October 3rd. Services are October 7th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Michael's Catholic Church in South Sioux City. Burial will be after the service at the Dakota City Cemetery. Visitation will be October 6th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel, 1801 Morningside Avenue. And we'll now go to another sports story. It is about an NFL team, but it's about a local person. Packers honor BB, Hornick, Iowa councilman recognized by favorite NFL team. Hornick, Iowa native Eric Beebe grew up in Wisconsin, but never had been to a Green Bay Packers game at Lambeau Field. That changed Sunday, thanks to a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity by the Packers. The Packers invited Beebe, his wife Patricia, and the kids Sariana and Wyatt to their game against the Steelers as part of the Operation Fan Mail program. "It was once in a lifetime," Beebe said in a telephone interview. "I hope it's something we don't forget. When you walk into Lambeau Field, it is its own little world. We were sitting on the Miller Lite deck, and I looked down and I said, 'Oh my, we're in Lambeau Field.'" Beebe submitted an essay with Patricia to the Packers earlier this summer, hoping to be picked by his hometown team. "Every home game, the Packers honor someone from the military for their service. The family member can be a spouse, mother, father, son, daughter, or sibling." He and his family waited for most of the summer for a response, but they did not hear anything until September 24th. Eric Beebe saw a Green Bay phone number pop up on his phone, but didn't think anything of it. He answered, but at first he thought it was a prank call. "They were real," he said. "We didn't want to tell our kids at first because we wanted it to be a surprise. We figured they were going to miss a day of school, so we went ahead and told them." The Packers answered back Monday. That's when Beebe knew it was the real deal. He and Patricia accepted the invitation, and the family of four were on their way to Green Bay. Considering the BBs had watched hundreds of games on television, they were all surprised by the in-person atmosphere. It gave Wyatt a whole new perspective on what football is like at the highest level, while Sariana hadn't seen a football game above the youth football level. "Seeing the crowd and how they get into it, they were excited about all of it," Eric Beebe said. The program recognizes military families and veterans at each Packers home game, marking its 15th season in 2021. In addition to being recognized on the video boards prior to the game, selected families will receive 4 tickets to the game courtesy of WPS Health Solutions and a $150 Packers Pro Shop gift card. "To be recognized by my favorite team, my son's favorite team, you just can't put it into words," Beebe said. "I grew up and watched them my whole life, but to get a call to get recognized in front of 78,000 people is just awesome. I was glad to share that with my family." The family of four got to see a Packers win too, as they beat the Steelers 27-17. Beebe is a city councilman in Hornick, but his full-time job is with the 185th Air Refueling Wing in Sioux City. Beebe serves as the base's cybersecurity manager as a Department of Defense civilian during the week, and he serves as a traditional Air Guardsman on drill weekends. He's part of a 5-person shop and makes sure the computer systems are performing well to avoid any hackers. Patricia Beebe is also a full-time employee at the 185th. She works in the Human Resource Department. Eric Beebe will have 19 years of service come November, and it all started on September 11, 2001. He was in college at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. He got up to go to class and saw some friends watch television in the dorm lobby. Beebe thought they were watching a movie. They were watching live coverage of the first plane hit the World Trade Center, and that stopped Beebe in his tracks. "The following week, I saw a recruiter. I dropped out of class and was in basic training in Fort Benning, Georgia in 2002. Beebe was stationed in Germany from 2003 to 2011, and that's where he met Patricia. Beebe was deployed to Afghanistan thrice. He was also stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, and then spent some time in Africa. We'll now move from sports to the business section, and there's an automotive story. And the headline is U.S. auto sales slump over chip shortage. Forecasters expect September auto sales down 25%. In a normal month before the pandemic, Con Palace Chevy dealership in Jerome, Idaho, sold around 40 new vehicles. In September, it was only 6. Now he's got nothing new in stock, and every car, truck, or SUV on order has been sold. Last month, what happened at his dealership about 115 miles southeast of Boise was repeated across the country as factory closures due to a worsening global shortage of computer chips crimped U.S. new vehicle shipments. Forecasters expect that September sales fell around 25% from last year as chip shortages and other parts supply disruptions cut into the selection on dealer lots and raised prices once again to record levels. That sent many frustrated consumers to the sidelines to wait out a shortage that has hobbled the industry since late last year. J.D. Power expects the U.S. automakers sold just over 1 million vehicles in September for an annual sales rate of 12.12 million. That's 4 million lower than last year's annual rate for September and 4.9 million below the rate of September of 2019. For the third quarter, J.D. Power expects sales to fall just over 13% from the same period a year ago. Automakers on Friday were reporting some pretty poor numbers. General Motors, which only reports sales by quarters, said its deliveries were off nearly 33% from July through September of last year. Stellantis, formerly Fiat Chrysler, saw quarterly sales dip 19% when Nissan sales were down 10% for the quarter. Honda's U.S. sales fell almost 25% last month and were down 11% for the quarter. At Toyota, sales were off 22% for September, but up just over 1% in the third quarter. Hyundai reported sales of off 2% last month, but up 4% for the third quarter. Volkswagen third quarter sales were down 8%. Most automakers report monthly or quarterly sales figures on Friday. September results show that there are simply not enough vehicles available to meet consumer demand, said Thomas King, president of data and analytics at J.D. Power. The average sales price of a new vehicle hit a record of $42,802 last month, breaking the old record of $41,528 set in August. The average U.S. price is up nearly 19% from a year ago when it broke $36,000 for the first time. The auto price increases have helped to drive up U.S. inflation. General Motors, hit hard by temporary plant closures last quarter, expressed some optimism, though. Steve Carlisle, president of GM North America, said the computer chip shortage is improving. As we look to the fourth quarter, a steady flow of vehicles held at plants will continue to be released to dealers. We are restarting production at key crossover and car plants, and we look forward to a more stable operating environment through the fall, he said. The shortage and crazy high prices for both new and used vehicles began with the eruption of the pandemic last year, when many states issued stay-at-home orders. Prices plummeted and automakers shuttered factories for 8 weeks. The resulting decline in supply came just as many cooped-up consumers wanted a new or used vehicle to commute to work or to take road trips without coming in contact with others. Now I have a couple of articles under the headline Siouxland Strange. The first one, there's another awful social media craze that's got the young ones spellbound, and it seems that kids in Northwest Iowa have gotten wind of it. The school restroom is no longer a quiet retreat for cigarette breaks, but is now the site of something as sinister as it's baffling. The Sioux County Sheriff's Office warned in a recent press release of a nationwide vandalism trend called Devious Licks, which has apparently made its way into schools in Sioux County. Devious Licks encourages middle and high school age students to vandalize and steal items from their school bathrooms, according to the news release. The viral fad, spread via the social media platform TikTok, is thought to have taken root in early September. According to an array of breathless new reports on the Devious Licks phenomena, along with widely shared photos, the items taken are usually the only things that can be readily lifted from a school bathroom, toilet paper, paper towels, and soap dispensers. In numerous instances, however, plumbing fixtures have been ripped out and mirrors have been broken. Sioux County Sheriff's Department and School Resource Officer Waylon Palima has been monitoring the situation and working with school administrators to address concerns regarding their buildings and sanitary facilities. Most area schools are taking a hard stand on this. Actions like this could be problematic with consequences for students who choose to vandalize and steal school property, Palima said in the press release. And then the next one is serial car smasher-upper. A Sioux City man was arrested September 20th on numerous, criminal mischief charges after he allegedly used rocks to dent and break the windows of 8 vehicles near a Pierce Street apartment building. At around 3:18 a.m. September 20th, 30-year-old Hagos Megastebe of Sioux City used rocks to smash the windshield, side windows, side mirrors, and doors of unoccupied vehicles in the 1000 block of Pierce Street, according to a criminal complaint. Megastebe was intoxicated and told officers he'd been at a bar earlier in the evening, had been in an altercation at around the same time as he was damaging the vehicles. The damage to each vehicle was estimated around $350, with a cumulative damages calculated at around $2,800. Megastebe was charged with 8 counts of fourth-degree criminal mischief and was held in the Woodbury County Jail on a $5,000 bond. We'll now move to a story called Living the Sweet Life with Honey Producer Fathead Farms. And this is about Northeast Nebraska honey operation. Kathy and Brian Sushan manage hundreds of beehives in more than 25 locations across Nebraska's Colfax and Stanton counties, so it can be challenging to find time to visit Fathead Farms, their Northeast Nebraska honey operation. But if you're able to get there, it's well worth it. The beekeeping couple lives in a Schausch, that's S-H-O-U-S-E, a large outbuilding equal parts living quarters and shed, on a farmstead a few miles south of Clarkson. A welcoming patio opens directly into a storybook kitchen with sealed concrete floors, dark blue cabinetry, and gleaming wood counters accented with plants and meaningful antiques. A breezy loft provides ample room for entertaining, the north wall lined with repurposed bee boxes full of cookbooks and beekeeping references. Kathy grew up in Charlotte, Nebraska, but spent time in South Carolina, where her bee obsession began to emerge during the urban farming craze. It started with backyard chickens and went from there, she reminisces. 11 years later, she's even more enamored with the craft. A fourth-generation beekeeper, Brian grew up in Omaha, spending time with his grandfather and father tending bee yards in Colfax and Stanton counties, as well as a Boys Town farm near his childhood home. Unassuming, patient, and incredibly knowledgeable, Brian keeps his primary focus on the bees, whereas Kathy handles beekeeping duties along with some of the more customer-facing tasks involved in running the business. Now used as an office and a bottling facility, the farmhouse on the Sushan's property is more than 100 years old, evoking a comforting nostalgia. Kathy is admittedly obsessed with the vintage appliances that grace both the Schausch and the farmhouse kitchens. The former parlor serves as a bottling area, furnished with a honey creamer, bottle filler, and barrel of honey. Storeroom shelves are lined with bottled honey varieties ready for mailing. Another room, resplendent with the original wallpaper, is used for shipping. Every jar is touched by one, and usually both of the Sushans, then packaged with love and a bit of swag. Porkchop, the smooshy-faced bulldog depicted on the label and inspiration for the Fathead name, arrived on the farm as a pup. He was so tiny he fit into the crook of my arm, Brian remembers. The couple later brought Harley home as a pal for Porkchop. Most recently, the aptly named Queen, Porkchop's biological mama, joined the family to keep everyone in line. Kathy's geese, Jim and Jack, can often be found honking their heads off in a tiny yard outside an adjacent outbuilding and splashing around in a little stock tank they consider their own personal pond. Nearby, completely oblivious to the geese cacophony, two pigs named Louise and Waylon root around among a few chickens. Their buddy Leonard has been feeling a bit under the weather lately and is stationed in a cozy shelter up near the house. The Sushan's hives are scattered around the county in bee yards. Local landowners contact the couple to offer up pastures of grasses and wildflowers for hives and are paid rent by way of honey. A nearby yard situated on the north side of Grassy Trail holds several rows of stacked beehives. These are carniolan bees, a less common species in the U.S. than the more popular Italian honeybee. Adept at hunkering down in cozy clusters along the Through the frigid Nebraska winters, the breed proves a bit more adaptable to variable nectar supplies and pest resistance. One of the common questions the Souchans encounter is how often they get stung. All the time, Kathy admits, it's just part of the deal. Brian said that Carniolan bees do have a calm temperament, but if it rains and they can't work for days, or if it's too hot, they get a little cranky. The Souchans use wooden Langstroth hives, often handed down through generations, marked with a family name and sometimes other family tidbits, not unlike pressing your hand into a fresh concrete or carving your initials into an attic beam. Each hive houses a queen bee and her brood, comprising one family. The bottom two boxes of a stacked hive are reserved exclusively for the queen, where she will lay up to 2,500 eggs daily to be nurtured for 21 days until they hatch. Before removing the frames of the hive to inspect the bees, Brian puffs pine needle smoke to calm them down. The buzz is mesmerizing, and even a new visitor to a hive can forget about the possibility of being stung while getting caught up watching the workers move in and out and scrutinizing a frame dotted with newly hatched eggs. At the height of the season, each hive will contain between 60,000 and 100,000 bees. Supers, or honey boxes, are added to the hive in early summer to provide plenty of workspace for the girls, the worker bees, to produce comb and fill with honey. The worker bees head out for the day, gathering nectar to bring back to the hive. The bees then deposit the nectar into the comb, flapping their wings forcefully to extract water. Once the comb is filled, it's capped with beeswax to preserve the honey inside. This frenetic activity, referred to as the flow, picks up from mid to late summer and typically lasts for 4 to 6 weeks. In a stellar year, the flow can take up to 8 weeks. It depends on the nectar source and the weather, Brian says. Too much rain prevents the bees from gathering. The early honey is delicious, light, floral, not cloying, but definitely sticky. When collection time arrives, the scrupulously clean harvest building is abuzz with activity using equipment that dates back to the 1970s and 80s. All processing is done the old-timey way, Kathy says. Newer, more automated equipment is available, but the Souchans prefer to stick with the classics they know. To harvest, the operator removes frames from the supers, then sends them through a conveyor belt with chains that remove the wax cap. On the opposite side, a second person grabs a frame, glides it into the receiving grooves of an extractor that uses centrifugal force to pull the honey out. The honey is strained into barrels and then goes into drums for storage. The bottling process proceeds via a tube that runs from the drum to the bottle filler. With the press of a button, the honey streams into the labeled bottles and is ready for sale. If the product in the drums crystallizes, it's cozied up in a warm blanket to return it to hive temperature, but it is never heated. To create creamed honey, granulated honey is churned with regular honey in a motorized mixer, resulting in a smooth, spreadable product. The final batches of creamed honey are produced during the winter because temperature affects the mixture's ability to emulsify. An avid and accomplished cook, Kathy develops and tests recipes for the farm's 17 craft honey flavors, jokingly remarking that the best ideas come after one too many beers. She tests combinations in small batches, tweaking until the ratios are perfect. Infusions like the spicy killer bee honey are done cold. Kathy simply adds the flavor to be infused and lets the honey rest until the intended flavor level is achieved. Popular sellers include a bourbon barrel-aged product and creamed salted citrus, chocolate ghost pepper, peanut butter, and lavender matcha varieties. The Souchans love to share their passion for beekeeping, mentoring newbies, and collaborating with other hive owners. Their advice to newcomers is to conduct as much research as you can, join a bee club to gain knowledge, and find a mentor. They also recommend reserving bees starting in January as they sell out quickly. We love to know everyone we work with, from those picking up bees for the first time to the representatives from stores, Kathy says. It's cool to touch on every aspect. Most aspiring beekeepers collect their five-frame nucleus hives from the Souchans by mid-May. The couple hopes to make the pickups into a celebration in the future, providing ample opportunity for patrons to meet other like-minded folks and talk bees. I've always wanted my own business, Kathy muses. It's so rewarding to go through the whole hive to jar process, from tending the hives to being able to hand the customer a jar of honey. The true entrepreneurs like the Souchans thrive on all aspects of the business: beekeeping, harvesting, developing flavors, meeting customers, and learning new ideas. Fathead Farms honey can be ordered online or purchased at select regional stores and festivals. Kathy loves seeing the faces of her regular customers each season, sharing recipes and hearing feedback about the products. Local customers have the option of picking up their orders from an adorable honey wagon parked in front of the farm. When it comes to buying honey, how do you know you're getting the real deal? Know your beekeepers and farmers, exclaims Kathy. We produce raw, small-batch honey in a 100% hands-on environment using practices passed down for generations. Looking out for the bees, keeping them healthy, and working as a team with Brian makes me proud of this life we have created. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, October 5th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.